Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton. Most of you know me. I'm the creator and host of this series. And for those who might be new to me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a rich and far-ranging public dialogue about how spirituality can play a key role in helping human beings find the interior resources that we need in order to rise to the challenges of a world that is in crisis. And our spirituality has to somehow enable us to do things we've never done before and make a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. So I've had the privilege of holding a series of profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of the leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders of our time. Those of you who are already registered know that you can get these for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, and you can just press the tab for archive and download any of these dialogues. This morning, I'm really happy to be joined by an old friend, Arjuna Arda, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation titled, Cancel Your Subscription to Enlightenment. Now, the way this will work is I'll introduce Arjuna, and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up in a little over 90 minutes. Arjuna Arda has been on the spiritual path for many years, having spent time with some of the most famous and well-known teachers of the past several decades. When I first met him, he was teaching hypnotherapy. I think it was in 1987. He was already a longtime spiritual aspirant. He'd spent time with Bhagavan Rajneesh, who later changed his name, or maybe already had changed his name to Osho. And we lived in this area where I still live. Arjuna has moved to the mountains, but at that time we lived nearby one another. We became friends when our children were small. But then I didn't see him for several years, and during that time his whole life and even his name changed. I met him as Nick Arda. He had gone to Lucknow, India, where he met the revered and very influential teacher H.W.S. Punja, or Papaji, a great sage and a devotee of Ramana Maharshi, who gave him the name Arjuna and told him to teach. And he did that. He was holding satsangs. I remember particularly they were very widely attended in Seattle. I was hearing about them. But then Arjuna said essentially that was not the true form. For you know that being in that mode of the satsang teacher wasn't true for him, and he had some very interesting things to say about that. I think a lot of them were expressed in the book he published in 2005. It's probably his best-selling book. It's called The Translucent Revolution, and in it he argued that tens of thousands of people are awakening in a way that is not quite as perfected as the enlightenment proposed by the ancient texts, but it's transforming something important about their identities and making them, if not transparent, translucent. And he has continued to teach all kinds of processes about awareness. He calls himself an awakening coach and a teacher. He's a teacher of coaches as well. He's also a prolific writer and teacher and public speaker. He's the author of 7 books, many audio and video products. Some of his books are Let Yourself Go, Relaxing into Clear Seeing, Awakening into Oneness, How About Now, and The Last Laugh. His most recent book is Leap Before You Look. And he's the founder of the Living Essence Foundation in Nevada City, California, a nonprofit dedicated to the awakening of consciousness in the context of ordinary life. So thank you for being with me here, Arjuna. I'm really happy to have you join us and enliven this ongoing public conversation. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Terry. You know, before we continue, I think I owe you a personal apology here. I probably had your little heart pitter-pattering at an alarming rate because I couldn't get onto the call through no fault of yours or your technology. I was actually my my computer had run out of batteries, and I just couldn't get it to start again. So I couldn't get the number off the computer. So I'm really apologize for any anxiety I caused you by showing up so late to the party.
Brad and I had a plot. I was going to introduce you while he phoned you up.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you didn't need the plot anyway. Very good. Well, it's great to be with you again, and it's wonderful to discuss these very controversial topics. In fact, it was interesting, just as you introduced me very kindly, it was interesting how I even found things to argue about in your introduction of me. So I'm going to be a very difficult guest today, and probably
that'll make it lively, because I'll come right back at you. That's terrific. I want to invite you to argue with whatever you want in that introduction as a part of answering kind of the first question. Maybe can lay out the ground of this whole conversation.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the obvious question: what do you mean when you say we should cancel our subscription to Enlightenment? Please lay that out.
Right.
And perhaps in the process, you might argue with maybe my characterization of your path.
I'll argue with myself.
Of Papaji.
I'll argue with myself for an hour. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
As a former satsang teacher.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the thinkers who I, or teachers or writers who I really celebrate the most from the 20th century was Gregory Bateson, who wrote a book called Towards an Ecology of Mind. I'm sure you would know it, being you're just the kind of guy who would enjoy Gregory Bateson.
I love Gregory Bateson. The map is not the territory.
Right, among many other things. So one of the things that Gregory Bateson wrote this book called Towards an Ecology of Mind that came out, I believe, in the 50s. I may be wrong about that. It was certainly popular by the 60s and 70s when I was a student. And he basically, in a nutshell, he coined the word schizoid, which later became the foundation of the understanding of schizophrenia. And basically, Gregory Bateson, he really initiated the understanding that human beings have a strong tendency towards duality, which means towards this or that. Either this is true or that's true. And he basically said that human beings, but life is not like that. Life is never this or that. Life is, the very essence of life is paradox. And so our evolution actually is contained in our capacity to embrace and live paradox, not to resolve paradox intellectually, because you can't. And this is perhaps the great shortfalling of maps and theories and ways of figuring things out, is that life is like a slippery eel that just slips through all of our attempts to make it logical. So actually, life itself contains, deeply within itself, it contains paradox, where two seemingly irreconcilable opposites are contained within the same living reality. And there are lots and lots of examples of that. I'll just give you some really crass, obvious kind of, you know, obvious examples that are not very exciting because they've been so explored already. But a really obvious example is free will and destiny, you know? And really, logically, intellectually, you have to choose one or the other. Either, you know, we all have free will, we're free beings, da-da-da-da-da, or everything is really like a roulette, like a billiard ball hitting other billiard balls, and one action causes a reaction, and therefore we're living in a completely cause and effect universe, and there is no free choice. And that's been a strong philosophical conversation for a long time. And in fact, if you look at our experience of free will and destiny, if you put aside intellectual arguments, our experience is that both are equally true. You absolutely do have freedom, and you absolutely are living within a web of karma, and both are completely true in a way, not 50-50, both 100% true in a way that your mind can't reconcile. And there are, of course, many, many, many other paradoxes like that. So I think we need to begin our conversation about, you know, what I would say about enlightenment in that understanding. So as I was listening to your introduction, so here's a couple of paradoxes to throw out, you know, that we are definitely in, you know, a time of great challenge. As you mentioned in your introduction, we're in a time of crisis, and yet in a strange way, right, in a strange way, the way to make the crisis worse is to view us as in a crisis, right? And the best thing you can do to alleviate crisis is to relax into the present moment and have gratitude for the beauty of this moment now. So that's a kind of strange paradox, that the way to avert a crisis is to not relate to the idea of crisis in your immediate experience, is to pay attention to what's healed, what's whole. And another interesting paradox that occurred to me as I listened to your introduction is to do with evolution. That certainly we can recognize evolution personally. I mean, absolutely, you and I and everybody we know have passed through all kinds of evolutionary bounds in our lifetimes. I mean, there are, you know, I remember that song from Lou Reed, you know, "You're still doing things that I gave up years ago." You know, so there's, you can recognize traits that you had when you were, you know, 20 that you definitely don't have now. So we can recognize personal evolution, and I think we can also recognize collective evolution. So, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the way that apartheid was overcome in South Africa, and not only that it happened, but the way it happened. These are all symptoms of collective evolution. However, here's another paradox, right? That actually evolution happens the more that we stay rooted in the present moment. Very strange kind of thing. This is, Ken Wilber talks about this a lot, that, you know, the best practice he recommends is a non-dual practice of staying in vastness. And so the more you actually rest in a place that is not evolving because it's still, the more evolution actually happens. The more you focus on the future, the more evolution is stopped. And this is a kind of a strange paradox, you know, that thinking about evolution or thinking about moving forwards actually takes you away from the present moment, which is where all evolution happens. So when I talk about cancelling your subscription to enlightenment, I would say this, you know, and we can look really deeply into this together. I would love to go deeply into this. I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot. It's the coffee, you know. But are you still there? Is anybody still there, or am I just talking to
us? We're all still there. In fact, there's several hundred people with us in this process right now,
but I'll finish
live,
up.
And there'll be thousands listening to the downloads. So you're
okay. 100%. Okay. So I'm not just talking to a phone. Okay.
Not at all.
Finish this paragraph. So, I think what we've got to get back to is this question that Andrew Cohen posed a long time ago, which is, what is enlightenment? You know, what is enlightenment? And why do we have this word in our vocabulary, and why is there so much discussion about it? So my teacher, Punjiji, who you referenced a little earlier, people used to ask him, what is enlightenment? You know, what is enlightenment? And his answer, I think, has really shaped the course of my life in the intervening 20 years, and it is actually almost 20 years to the day. I mean, just there's like four more days left, and it's 20 years to the day since I met him. And when people would ask him, what is enlightenment, he would say, enlightenment is a great answer, so stand by. Enlightenment is a word in the vocabulary of fools. Amazing answer. Enlightenment is a word in the vocabulary of fools. It's an amazing answer. Because what he's saying is, enlightenment is a word that you relate to when you're asleep, right? And actually, in any moment that you are aware of what's really here, in any moment that you're aware of the shimmering nature of consciousness experiencing all of this, in any moment that you're aware of the way that matter and spirit kind of merge in and out of each other, in any moment that you're aware of the interconnected web of love in which we are all kind of one and different at the same time, in any moment that you really wake up to what's going on, the word enlightenment is just a word. It means nothing. It's a concept. And it's very interesting to understand why, or to recognize why we got so so bound up with this concept. It's a very, very masculine concept. It's a hyper-masculine concept. It's a concept which women, or the feminine heart, doesn't come to on its own except when influenced by masculine people. And so if you actually recognize that enlightenment is a concept and doesn't really exist in the fabric of reality, what is left? What remains when you relax completely into this moment and give up the idea of any future state better than this one? What is left, of course, is an enormous amount of energy now available just to be here, to be here with what we have called shadow, as well as what we've called the light. So I emphasize this so much in my work because in my opinion, you know, this has just been my experience, the moment when you see through the myth of a future fixed state you're going to arrive at, the moment you give up on a goal you're working towards, that moment when you cancel your subscription to a future state you're working towards, that moment, I would say, is the biggest leap a human being can take in terms of spiritual maturity. Because you're left now just in free space. You know, you're left without a map. You're left without a path. You're left without a territory. You're left without anything. You're left just in a naked experience of this moment where time disappears. You know, I did an incredible thing the other day, and I'm really going to stop talking after this last piece. I did an incredible thing the other day with my son. He was going off to San Francisco State University to start his career as a student, as a college student. And the last thing we did together before I drove him to the college was we went to Davis Airport, and we went up in a plane, and we jumped out of a plane at 13,000 feet. And we were strapped to an instructor, of course, but we jumped out of this plane at 13,000 feet, and for between 13,000 and 5,000, we were just in free fall, just falling without a parachute yet. The parachute opens at 5,000 feet. Incredible experience to fall 8,000 feet without just nothing, you know. And that, to me, is a really good analogy for what happens when you abandon the idea of being on a path or working towards any kind of a goal. Now I will be quiet, Terry, and interact with you.
Well, that was beautiful, Arjuna. I thought you did a lovely job, and you know, I'd even like to expand on some of what you offered, because this idea of enlightenment has loomed as a measuring stick by which so many aspirants always are finding themselves to fall short, and the not yet, not enough, got to be perfect kind of framing has been, I think, a real problem. And I have many times said things very similar to what you're offering here, that that this idea of enlightenment and focusing on it can also, you know, it has a number of negatives. One of them is that it makes people very self-focused. Well, how am I doing? Where am I on the path? How, you know, this self-measurement and self-evaluation over against an unattainable ideal, it just turns spirituality into something that isn't even terribly healthy in most people's lives. So I've felt that it was terribly important to liberate ourselves from all those limitations and back into that which is our freedom. And you're pointing in what you're offering to what's sometimes called the sudden school, that every bit of conversation about it takes us out of this living moment in which the radiant transcendental conscious reality of that is the nature of all things is somehow not emphasized. We're looking at some fragment of things or some angle on things instead of resting and reawakening into the shimmering aliveness, as you put it.
Yeah, so I would equally advise people to cancel their subscription to a membership in a sudden school. Sudden schools are very problematic as well because, you know...
you were more or less, though, articulating what is said in the sudden schools,
except this, we need to come back again, I would say, to this thing, the beauty of paradox, to see that as soon as you settle in any particular position about anything, look to the opposite position and see how that is also true. So the thing of what you're referring to is sudden schools. I mean, Dzogchen would be an example of a sudden school, or the non-dual Advaita teachings that Ramana is famous for, and my teacher Punjiji. The difficulty with a sudden school, if it's taken in isolation, is there's this emphasis that consciousness is perfect, you are consciousness, there's only this moment, and therefore there is absolutely nothing wrong anywhere, there's no problem, there's no time, there's no you, there's no me, there's no nothing, So there's no need to look at anything because you've just got to rest back in presence. And we've seen again and again and again teachers who make this into a teaching, you know, and there's usually, you know, all kinds of skeletons in the closet. You know, there was, I mean, just recently in the last few years, there have been, you know, endless examples of non-dual teachers who get into terrible scandals because, you know, sexual, financial, or whatever scandals, because the willingness to look at yourself honestly as a human being has been put aside in what is often called spiritual bypassing. So really, the beautiful thing
is... Well, the deconstructing of the story, which is what you were advocating for, and what Byron Katie eloquently went through with me just a few weeks ago...
Yes, yes.
...is there's no denying that. That is an absolute whole of the, you know, there is no paradox that excludes that, that is adequate. You know, that is absolute. But of course, I stand with you. The sudden school without the gradual school becomes the talking school. It becomes the school of spiritual bypassing.
Right.
On the other hand, the gradual school without the sudden school becomes the school of labored seeking and always not there.
So here we are now. Here we are arrived in the beauty of the paradox. And the beauty of the paradox is that this moment is perfect. You can't deny if you just open your heart. I'm standing in a forest right now. I decided to take advantage of a cordless phone and be out in the sunshine. So I'm standing surrounded by trees that are shimmering in their aliveness. I mean, it's just unbelievably beautiful. I'm standing in a forest of fir trees and... they're all alive. There are hundreds of them around me. They're like they're living beings, and you can't deny the absolutely overwhelming miracle of life, which is here. And then from there the undeniable, spacious, limitless consciousness, which is also love, which is experiencing all of this. And so that's one piece of the paradox, and the other piece of the paradox is that there is the appearance of a person. And as soon as this body tries to move around in time and space and particularly relate to other bodies, there is a story kicks in. And everybody's got a story, including Byron Katie. She's got a story about the work and her husband and all. Everybody's got a personal story, right? And that story has to somehow also be included in the paradox where there's nobody here and there absolutely is somebody here. And this somebody who is here is fraught with all kinds of limitations and delusions and lies they tell themselves and lies they tell other people, and all of that somehow is only problematic when it's resisted, when we want to somehow eradicate it. And this has been this is one of the big troubles with the concept of enlightenment, is that it usually involves the eradication of the ego, which also doesn't exist, by the way, but you've got to wipe out the ego in order to reach enlightenment. The thing is that the story also has its place. It has its place in a relative kind of a way. But paradoxically, the best way to be free of the story is to completely accept it, to completely accept it with its moments of defeat, with its moments of ambition, with its moments of comparison, as well as its moments of celebration of another's triumphs. So this is actually what, to me, what opens up, you don't really have to adopt a school. And I don't really, I'm not a member of any school. I have as much I have as much complaint, you could say, with the sudden school as the gradual school, if they're taken as a school. But if you put aside all schools, imagine that. Imagine, you remember the moment when school's out, you know? I mean, do you remember when you finished 12th grade?
Yippee!
You know,
yeah.
High school's finished, and you're like...
Throw your hat in the air.
Throw your hat in the air and you're done, you know, and the rules and the protocol and the way that things should be, it's all finished. You walk out and maybe the next day you meet your, I guess you probably graduated high school, what, in the early 70s? Would that be, you're about the same age as me, mid 70s?
I'm afraid I was in the class of 69. I'm a little older than
all right.
you.
A little older than me. Okay. God, you're almost dead, aren't you? Okay. So anyway. So
not dead yet, Arjuna.
Not dead yet. Not still alive and kicking. So you step out of high school on the last day, and the next day you meet your high school principal, right? And you're standing on the street, 69. I don't know. Maybe you're smoking a joint in 69. I don't know. But you're. you can do whatever you want. You can have a cube of beer in your hand, you know, and you can look at that principle. You can say, how you doing, principal? Because it's over. The game that you tell me what to do, the game that there are rules, the game that there's a kind of an academic path, it's all done. I'm free. I now play by my own rules. And that, I would say, in a certain way, with certain, you know, maybe sensible caveats, that, I would say, is the incredible leap that many people are taking. They are actually graduating the identity of being a spiritual seeker or an aspirant or being on a path or having frameworks to follow or any of that. They're stepping aside from all of that, and not with anger, not to take a stance against something, because then you're equally embroiled in it, but just to say thank you for the crutches, thank you for the scaffolding, but now I'm a big enough tree, and actually I'm just going to live in a naked relationship with reality, with no maps. And then the beautiful thing is, when you don't feel any obligation to have a relationship to any map, and this is, incidentally, you talked about awakening coaching, this is what awakening coaching is really about, is to encourage people to have a rich spiritual life without needing to follow somebody else's rule book. So, you know, that's the whole beauty of coaching. If you forget about the awakening part, coaching is always client-centered. So we have actually a spiritual approach to coaching, which is incredibly client-centered. And generally speaking, clients don't come up with the idea, or people don't come up with the idea of enlightenment on their own. It's always been taught to them by somebody else. So if you cancel your subscription to all that, in just in the same way, when high school ends, you can be grateful for the education, but now you're done. You don't have to abide by the rules anymore. Then everything becomes possible. And then you're not following a sudden school. You're not following a gradual school. You're just in the forest, feeling the trees, your heart open in an excitement to be involved in the great dance, in the great play, which includes the incredible perfection of this moment, and it also includes the invitation to have humility and honesty and to face the blemishes of the individual who will probably never be perfected. I think this is another, you know, another reason to cancel your subscription to the enlightenment, because enlightenment suggests that this person who you've taken yourself to be is one day going to be completely fixed and will one day cease to be neurotic. And will one day no longer be controlling or needy or whatever. And good luck, I say, because I've not actually found anybody who has ever perfected their human incarnation. We are quirky by nature, you know. I remember years ago I met Ramdas, who of course preceded all of us in the exploration of these things. He got really big into LSD with Timothy Leary. He went off to meet Neem Karoli Baba in the 60s. And then he did everything you can imagine.
Incidentally, there are two beautiful interviews with Ram Dass, one of which had a lot of technical difficulty, but which is in some ways richer even for it, available for download if you haven't already listened to them as a part of this series.
Beautiful.
Go ahead.
So I remember in the early 90s I met Ram Dass, and this is before his stroke, and he said, you know, I picked up one of those magazines, there are those magazines you get that are free in health food stores, and they have all of the different kinds of self-improvement classes listed. And he said, you know, I picked up one of these magazines, and I think I had tried everything listed. You know, I've tried Rolfing, I've tried Rebirthing, I've tried Primal Scream, I've tried Aura, everything I've done. He said, I think I can say with some confidence now, after 30-something years of trying all these things, I think I can say with some confidence that I have not actually managed to heal or remove one neurotic habit from my personality. I have not actually succeeded in improving Richard Alpert in any tiny way. But, he said, the effort to try and improve Richard Alpert, and that's his legal name, and to fail again and again and again and again and again has actually given me a sense of humor and a sense of acceptance for this quirky, egoic identity, which is my vehicle for getting around in the world. And that, you know, that's what I mean by translucent. Perhaps we can jam on that for a moment. I wrote this book in 2005 called The Translucent Revolution. And I used the word translucent exactly because I wanted to differentiate it from the idea of enlightenment. But translucent simply means, you know, it's like an object can be translucent. You know, there's a, you can have a transparent object would be like a sheet of completely clean glass, so clean that if you walk up to it, you could bang your nose on it because you don't even see it's there. And that's really what the idea of enlightenment is trying to promise, that you can sort of erase yourself so there's really nobody left and there's just this, there's just pure consciousness, which is a very masculine thing to want to do. It's a very hyper-masculine trance to want to kind of erase yourself, and we can talk about that in a minute. Then on the other hand, there are opaque objects, and like a solid wall is opaque. You could shine a bright light on one side of a solid wall. So long as there are no windows in the wall, the inside of the wall could be pitch black and not one bit of light would have passed through. That's an opaque object. A translucent object would be like a crystal, you know, or a piece of stained glass. You shine light on it, and then it appears to glow as if from the inside. You shine light on a translucent object, and it's lit up from within. It seems to shine from within. Although it retains its color, it retains its blemishes. You know, a crystal could have a crack in it, for example, and still be lit up from inside. It's the same thing that the great, great, great master of paradox, Leonard Cohen, who really, you know, he's the guy I would recommend everyone turn to as a spiritual teacher. If
he really is he's the man, isn't he?
He's the man. He's the man. Yeah, he leaves all the shrees behind in the dust, you know. But Leonard Cohen, he said, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. It's the most incredibly beautiful line. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. He said,
it's in the song Anthem, for those of you who,
yeah.
A song worth seeking out and listening to, by the way.
Right. So that's really a little bit, you know, what we come to in translucence is you realize, yes, as a person, if I'm going to speak about an I or a me, yes, there is an I or a me, and it's broken. It's broken. It's broken beyond repair, which means that the habits of control and comparison, the small habits of the me, are so deeply ingrained into this body, are so deeply inherited from mother and father. How long have we been trying to get rid of them without success? Those habits are so deeply ingrained, they kind of define, in a way, the nature of the me. But the liberation is not in trying to fix the me, which is the idea of enlightenment, or eradicate the me. The liberation comes to be still in the midst of the chaos of the me, to be still and know in that moment, as the Master Jesus said, to know that I am God. You know, be still and know that I am God. But of course, people hear it like, be still and know that I, Jesus Christ, am God. But I think, I like to think what he was saying was, be still and know in that moment that I am me, the one who is still, is God in the midst of this chaos of incarnation. So that's the meaning of translucence. It's not a perfection of the individual. It's not a transcendence of the individuality. It's not even a healing of the individuality. Translucence means that there is a recognition of your true nature as limitless, which can come in moments, in snapshots, or in more abiding visits. There is a recognition of your true nature, but there is also an absolute humility and humor to accept the personality for what it is. Now, that is not the attainment of a state. That is actually the relaxation from the attempt to attain a state. And I want to say that again because I just love to hear that. It's not the attainment of a state. It's not the attainment of a higher state of consciousness. It is the relaxation from any attempt to be in a different place than you are. And there's the freedom. There's the beauty that was right under your nose all the time. But it was only obliterated. It was only hidden. That beauty was only hidden by our incessant attempt to become something different than we already are.
Beautiful, 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 Arjuna. And I have to say I'm impressed yet again at how you silver-tongued devil, you're such a poet of freedom. I'm
drug,
captured.
It's drug.
I'm captured. Yeah, it's drugs. I know. I'm captured, really, sincerely. And yet, I think my job here and my duty really is to
give me a hard time.
Give you a hard time as best I can, even though I'm falling in love, even as I go. And there are a few things here that deserve.
Do you think this would be a good moment right here on this teleseminar? Do you think this would be a good moment for you and I to come out about our clandestine homosexual relationship? I would think right on the air might be a good time to declare it, you know? What better time, or should we wait? Maybe we should wait.
I've got to say, you're dancing at a level that. I'm just not ready to come out about it, Arjuna. I'm afraid.
Yes.
I just can't
edit
deal.
That out from the recording. Okay. Okay.
Well, here are a couple of things. One is, you know, as beautifully as you speak about it, part of what you're not speaking to directly is that in this inclusion of both sides of paradox, in this inclusion of the radical freedom that is here in the acceptance of what is, of my whole self, of our whole self. And I've got to say, you know, hats off again, when you wrote that book, The Translucent Revolution, you were giving voice to something that was arising spontaneously as an awareness in thousands and thousands of us. And I thought that it was a real service to everyone that you put it into a book that made the thesis really present. But part of that incarnational, non-dual acceptance of the complexity and paradoxical and human nature of our freedom, our divinity, and our brokenness, all simultaneous, right here, right now, not a problem, is a willingness then to engage with the moment. And that moment might, we have to acknowledge how it seems to us. And for instance, there is a difference between this particular moment of crisis and previous moments of crisis. There are intensities that build. And the consciousness that conceives of it in a fixed way as a crisis creates a problem, absolutely, and defines oneself as someone who's a victim of a problem and working, you know, you're already in a hole you're digging yourself out of instead of just present and free. On the other hand, for a group of people to mobilize their resources effectively in relation to anything, they do need to have a description of things and a willingness to engage that and a willingness to be alive to one another, present, broken, we're, you know, all of us admitting how in our moments of identification with any piece of this, with our children, with ourselves, we're afraid. The circumstance of crisis throws us into places of real concern, and we're...
Yeah.
But also knowing that we're completely free and we're accessing a kind of transcendental identity. But it seems to me that there's a potential for a kind of profundity of connection and a vulnerability and a tenderness and an immediacy that can't be there if we're speaking quite in the way you just were, just sort of celebrating the inherent freedom of the present moment. We have to chunk in and deal with the patterns that seem to be presenting themselves, don't we?
Okay, yeah, okay. So, okay, you know, I've been speaking about the capacity to embrace paradox, and maybe, as inevitably happens, maybe I was leaning too heavily into one side of the paradox in speaking, because on the one hand, there is the... Okay, let's go into this. On the one hand of the paradox, there is this, you could say, celebration of the present moment. But the other piece that I also spoke of is the willingness to fully and unconditionally experience and be present with this incarnate identity, not just as an individual, but this incarnate identity as 7 billion incarnations in human form. To be present with all that without the knee-jerk reaction to try and change it or fix it right away. And, well, you know, there is a kind of a healing that happens, but it happens more effectively when you're not trying to fix it. So let's
yes, absolutely that. So. Absolutely
let's
so. That is the paradox, isn't it? You're right.
We can't do
anything without that.
Yes. So look, so on the one hand, it's both of these things together, and they seem to be irreconcilable, because on the one hand, there's this, wow, there's this recognition of spaciousness. On the other hand, you cannot flinch away from or avoid anything arising in the body-mind mechanism. Now, I'm going to give you a very, very personal example here, okay? Very personal example. I happened to have been born into, and who knows the mechanisms whereby, you know, we end up, you know, inheriting the particular traits we do. But I was born into a family with a lot of mental illness. In my immediate family, there were three suicides. In my immediate kind of close relatives, three people committed suicide. And the ones who didn't commit suicide were all very emotionally and mentally unstable. So really, for me, you know, I got involved in spiritual practice when I was 14. And people, you know, sometimes when they hear that, go, oh, wow, you know, with such a, you must have been really, you know, very kind of whatever, you know, it was to be involved in spiritual practice at 14. Let me tell you, I got into spiritual practice at 14 out of desperation. Because it was around that time when I was 14 that I realized, oh my God, you know, my genes are all predisposed towards insanity. And, you know, I've got to do something drastic here. I mean, psychotherapy is definitely not going to be enough. Because, you know, really, I have inherited deeply suicidal, destructive tendencies. And it kind of worked in a way. It worked in the sense that I started to meditate when I was 14. And that's been a deep passion for me now for 40 years. Just as it's 20 years since I met Punjiji, it's right around. It's just a little more than 40 years since I first learned meditation. And so what's happened, you know, thanks be to God, is through all of that practice, what's happened is there's kind of opened up this dimension which is free, where there are no limits, which is at peace. But it doesn't take away from, it doesn't make these difficult tendencies in the psyche go away. So I regularly face the feeling of suicidal despair. And I don't mean, you know, I mean, I used to. I mean, like, you know, this weekend, I mean, it comes to visit. And no doubt if I hadn't begun to meditate, I would have, by now, would have given in to those tendencies. I would have killed myself. But it comes to visit, and I can experience it. And when I say experience it, I don't mean in a kind of detached, you know, witnessing way. I mean the what's necessary to be free is when it comes to visit, to completely go down into it, to descend all the way down into its core. But then paradoxically, it spits you out very quickly when you don't resist it. And so that's been my sadhana, you know, that's been my spiritual path because of having these quite difficult threads in the psyche that I inherited from my family. What I've had to learn to do is to not resist anything, to go into difficult feelings completely, just like jumping out of an airplane, to dive in completely. But then you learn rather like a whirlpool. If you ever see a whirlpool, you know, in a river or something, there's a whirlpool. If you get trapped in a whirlpool, if you fight it, you're going to drown. You know, if you get caught in a whirlpool and you try and swim to the surface, you're going to drown. If you just relax completely as though you're dead and let it draw you down into itself, it'll feel like you're drowning. But when you get to the very core of the whirlpool, the kind of the center of the vortex, it spits you out and you're free. That happened to me once. I got caught in a whirlpool and I just had to, you know, I just had to relax and go, okay, I'm going to drown. And it spat me out again. So in the same way, it happens with everything to do with our individuality. If you're willing to enter into the crucifixion every day, if you're willing to dive into whatever you mentioned, fear. You know, fear is a very strong feeling these days because of the shifting in our collective structures. But if you're willing to dive into fear, to dive into despair, to dive into feeling insulted or humiliated or whatever, if you're willing to go into it completely and not resist the human incarnation, that's actually the surest way. First, that it doesn't actually run your life, because whatever you allow kind of gets the poison gets taken out of the fangs of the viper when you allow it. So first, it becomes immune, but secondly, it actually becomes the best way to relax back into spacious consciousness. So please, maybe I underemphasize that when in speaking about this paradox, that you can't escape from either one. You know, in order to be able to live in an ongoing spirit of awakening now and now and now and now and now and now and now, it's necessary to have an opening to this luminous consciousness, which is your true nature, but also to have an absolutely unresisted attitude towards everything that arises, whether it's your own stuff, so to speak, or whether it's somebody else's, because, you know, as things get more chaotic, you're going to be dealing with a lot of other people's unresolved psychic stuff too. If you resist it, you're going to create separation and conflict. If you just allow it, let it move through, you're going to find yourself dropping more and more deeply into that sweet surrender, which is love itself. But it's not a love that excludes hatred. It's a love that includes hatred and jealousy and everything that it could possibly imagine.
Well, thank you. You know, Arjuna, there were some rich things I had intended to explore, and I see that your eloquent play here, you're I think unpacking this in a very rich way for people, but we're probably not going to get into some of the nuances. If you don't mind, I'd like to invite you to a period of a little bit shorter responses and more
sure.
interaction. And
sure.
And first of all, you just proposed what was to be an inclusive paradox, but, you know, both poles of that were subjective, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Bad feelings, free feelings. Whereas there's another pole, which is our objective relations and a world in which what happens now also matters. So the objective world and the circumstances that require our participation, you know, in some sense are referenced by, you know, other people and difficult feelings and the complexities of all that. I get that there is a kind of paying attention to that in what you said, but it goes much deeper. Much matters. And if all of us spiritual people are working with how we feel internally and good feelings and bad feelings and being able to be present in a transcendental way, but not we don't become actors in the world that are really effective and are able to really mean to produce a result. We don't swing for the fences. We don't really have an impact on the world. I think we're abnegating our responsibility in a different way. And that answer, although it was so complete in some respects, could easily be embraced in a way that wouldn't include this.
Okay, I'll give you the short. Okay, I know you want short answers. Okay, here's a short answer. So, I'm a quarter Jewish. My father's mother was Jewish, and somehow a rabbi told me that actually gives me a license to tell Jewish jokes. So here comes a Jewish joke. Okay.
I'm half Jewish. I have the same license. I agree with that. That's very good.
Okay, so there's a Moshe goes to the rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I'm in terrible trouble. We have 9 children at home. I'm working 3 jobs, 1 day job, 1 evening job, 1 night job. I don't know. I'm just in terrible trouble. I'm completely stressed. Don't get any sleep. 9 children. Now Ruth, just pregnant again with our 10th child. Rabbi, what should I do? And the rabbi raises his eyebrows and says, do, Moshe? Haven't you done enough? So this is a cue for peals of laughter now.
Yes.
You know, did you get the joke? Haven't you done enough?
Totally,
anyway?
Totally.
Yeah. So so the thing is, you know, in terms of political and social action, I would suggest to you that, you know, our responsibility really, in terms of spiritual activism, our responsibility is more with the spiritual part than the activism part. What I mean by that is, if you take care of your own reactivity, if you take care of, you know, if you include practices in your life that you are clear, you are fully able to feel everything that arises, life itself, you could say, or the big spirit, will guide you in what to do. And so it's not so much a feeling of doing something, but of serving an impulse which comes to you. It's very important, I would suggest, that we're aware of the difference between doing and serving, because, you know, when we do stuff, very often it's so influenced by our own agenda, our own belief system, that it's not necessarily in tune with the way that life is evolving. So what I attempt to do, you know, in my own life is to involve myself in practices, which are not practices to become enlightened later. They're practices to return back again and again to presence now. And then just to be available to see what wants to happen. And often It comes in the form of an invitation, like to have this dialogue with you, or it comes in the form of something, you meet somebody, and it's just, it's the obvious effortless thing is to say yes and to move forward in that direction. And my sense is, Terry, that the people who are really, really effective in healing the planet are in service to impulses beyond their own mind, rather than in what they think they should do in a kind of planned way. As short as I could manage.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I've talked with so many people on this topic, I've heard a real range of perspectives. Some of them really emphasize the being side, as you have, that dropping deep and finding oneself at the ground of one's own being, so that one's being, you know, is just sort of wells up as a serviceful doing that is rooted in the love that is the nature of our of being and of our relationship to whatever is arising. And then there are others who say, get into action and the world needs you, and act, and even if your action is wrong, that's okay. And others who say, well, you've got to have a framework that's adequate so that you see clearly and that your action responds. And I hold all of those in, you know, with deep respect, because they each hold an absolutely true perspective. As you were saying, this matter of holding paradox is a matter not of holding something that's halfway true and another apparently contradictory perspective that's also halfway true and splitting the difference, but of recognizing that they're each absolutely true. And I think that there's an absolutely true pole here that has to do with seeing what's around you and noticing that it requires a response, and that there are things that only you can do. Like, only you can cast the vote that is allocated to you by by law. If you don't vote, that vote isn't cast. Yeah. Only you can express the civic responsibility that arises in the place that you stand. These aspects of things tend to be underemphasized in the spiritual conversation, and we're widely criticized for that, of not really being adequate citizens. And I would like to hear more of that voiced in what you're saying, because although I agree and resonate profoundly, you're a poet, you know, very beautifully said, that I'm not hearing your passion for that piece of it as much as I'd like to.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, Terry, I mean, you should just talk to the people I live with, because they all complain that, you know, I work probably 16 hours a day. I'm, you know, maybe that's an exaggeration, but certainly more than 10. I'm extremely passionately involved in activities to shift the planet. My particular role happens to be, you know, to do with shifting, well, dissolving belief and shifting consciousness. But that's just one role. There are other people who do other things. It's just, you see, there's a big difference, you know, between allowing an impulse that is somehow connected to the big mind and doing something from a limited perspective. Now, very quick and short way to explain how I would see this is, we talk about points of view. This is a very kind of important aspect of our work in awakening coaching, is we talk about points of view. And so there are seven attributes to core coaching, seven core competencies. One of them is called radical releasing, which is a way of dissolving points of view. So really, in a nutshell, rather than trying to change negative beliefs into positive beliefs, we're just recognizing that any belief about anything is a limitation. And if you can dissolve belief, if you can learn how to dissolve belief, you drop deeper into a place of surrender to a much bigger source of creativity than your own separate mind. So here's the interesting thing, though, you see, is there are beliefs which will say yes to life. And those are basically desires. Those are basically grasping, you know, I want this, I want this. And then there are beliefs that say no to life, which say, no, I don't want that. Go away. Leave me alone. And both of them block the flow of life happening, block the flow of what in China they call the Tao, you know, the flow of the Tao. In India, they would say the flow of Dharma. in, I guess, in the West, we would say, you know, the flow of life, right? So one kind of belief or one kind of point of view that inhibits life from flowing is grasping and my idea of what should happen. And that's really how a lot of the world runs, you know, is people that are very revved up on caffeine or whatever and just have their agenda, or they just want to run their agenda. But there is also another kind of point of view that blocks life, which is really a renunciation of life, which is what spirituality has been associated with. So I think what you're referring to about spiritual people, so-called spiritual people, not being fully involved in life, it's because of this particular kind of point of view that says no to things, that actually will deny the impulses when they come, that will not surrender to the command of life to participate in a certain way. And what I've noticed, you know, because I've worked a lot with dissolving belief, what I noticed is I just have to go anywhere. You know, I just have to kind of go out and meet people. And all day long, life is giving me clues and directions and invitations. And you just really have to stay in a place of not grasping and not pushing away, and you will be called upon to serve. But that participation in the flow of life where you're being called upon, you know, is it's kind of feels effortless, but although it feels effortless, paradoxically, it's much more effective than having a fixed agenda. And another piece we can add, and I'll say this really short, because these are huge topics we're covering, Terry. We need like a week to talk about some of these things. But another piece is to do with our capacity to feel, you know, our capacity to feel feelings. Because if you try and take social or political action with a blocked capacity to feel, one thing is you're going to go into opposition with people all the time. You're going to see people as the enemy, because you don't have the capacity to feel other people's pain, you see. But also, if you try and take action without the capacity to feel, your action is fueled more by doing than by love. So as we, you know, a huge part of our work as individuals is just to restore our capacity to feel human feelings, which is not quite the same as often what's called spirituality. Is not the same as watching feelings. To feel feelings means to have an unsurrendered, undefended relationship to emotion when it comes. And if you can feel feelings completely, then when you hear about the more than 5,000 children a day who are starving to death, dying in Somalia and Kenya because of the worst drought in 60 years, when you hear that, if your heart is open, if your heart is tremoring with the capacity to feel, which starts in your own life, you're going to feel the plight of those children. You're going to want to do something about it. You're going to want to donate money. In the same way, you know, when you tune into Rush Limbaugh or one of these guys who you maybe totally disagree with intellectually, instead of getting into the intellectual position of, I disagree with this guy and I want to put him out, you can perhaps then feel the particular kind of emotional body he has and the particular kind of incapacity to feel he has. A really good example is Bush. You know, all of us left-wing spiritual types, we all went on a Bush-hating rampage for 8 years. And, you know, I can understand the temptation. I was, you know, very much a part of Bush bashing. I used to, you know, every time he made another slip of the tongue and mispronounce the word, I would relish it, you know, and I do a bit the same with Sarah Palin now because I disagree with these people politically. But, you know, what was really a great invitation was to feel George Bush's plight, you know, that he was born in this Texan family, very dominating mother, and he was alcoholic. He didn't really heal himself from alcoholism. He went to use religion as a kind of crutch to bypass alcoholism. So he was running on all this kind of unmet stuff. And there was this beautiful film made, you know, was called W, I think. It was a Oliver Stone film, I believe. Incredible service it did to all of us to see that there's a human being there. There's a human being struggling with his limitations to feel and actually causing havoc in the world as a result. You know, so there's a man, for example, very much thought he knew what to do, very much thought he could save the world by overcoming terrorism and blah, 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 blah. But you could see that his blocked capacity to feel meant that all of his big actions became chaotic. And I don't think that left-wing people are any less susceptible to that than right-wing people, you know. If you're running action without a fully healed heart, without a heart that can feel completely, your actions are going to end up creating more separation in the world. So best thing to do, I would say, is, you know, take care of yourself. You know, find ways to open your own heart. Find ways to make sure that when fear comes, you can really tremble with fear. And when hurt comes, you can really feel hurt. And when envy comes, you can really feel that too. And deeper than all that, that you can actually feel the big love, which is your true nature. And with that capacity to feel fully restored, go out in the world and experience everything, and you will be called to action by the conscience of your own heart. But if our action is coming from a political or a theoretical framework, we should do this, I would say the chances are that our actions may cause more harm than good.
Okay, well, there's so much here. You're right, we could go on for a week. I'd like to lean back in. I think there's a complexity. I think that in many ways, as people evolve, they find it distasteful to engage in the game of power and influence, and that for that reason, there's a great deal more political activity on the part of the kind of people that you and I don't so much resonate with, and those that are more connected to their care, and that we may be leaving the field in the hands of, you know, the A-team, those who are most sensitive and conscious, may be leaving the world to be more under the sway of the influence of less conscious people, the B-team. And so there are issues we could kind of pursue and pursue, but we've reached that time in our hour in which we need to take a break. So I have a few important announcements, and those of you who have questions for Arjuna or me, many of you have already sent questions via the instant message window in the instant teleseminar pane on your computer. If you've dialed in by telephone, if you press star 2 on your keypad, you'll be able to raise your hand. And I'd like to make sure that you know how to find out more about Arjuna's work. Most of that will come in an email that we'll be sending sometime this coming week. He has an offering he's just getting ready that isn't quite ready to announce, so there's no URL to announce. But we'll be sending that out in an email. There'll be a discount available for a new course that he's offering. Do you want to say a little more about that, Arjuna?
Yeah, just in a word or two. You mentioned Translucent Revolution, and that was a book, you know. So everything explored in that book, I've spent the last several years doing interviews on very high-quality video and audio and so on. I've created this course, which is a multimedia course, so you're not just reading stuff, you're interacting directly, and it has practices built into the course. It has really a variety of stories of people's awakening, so you can see just how prolific awakening is now, how much it's spread to all different kinds of people. And it's a course that really guides you through the possibility of a deeply spiritual life without working towards a goal of enlightenment. It's a course in living awakening now, in taking the awakening that you've already tasted and transforming it into a vibrant living experience now. I thought it was going to be ready today, but there's just a few final touches. So I think the best thing is just to hold off. And Terry, you said you'd be kind enough to send an email to people if they'd like to know more about that. So give us a few more days, and we'll have that up and running. I thought it was going to be ready, but it needs a few more tweaks. And then a very beautiful course, which has taken many years to perfect and has some extraordinary, extraordinary people sharing the very essence of what they've learned about all of this that we've been talking of today.
Yeah, great. And we will also post this on the Beyond Awakening blog. There is always the general tab, an announcement of each dialogue, and I will go in and I'll edit the announcement of this one so that the link to that is available. If you're listening to this by download some months after it's taken place, you'll be able to find it there. I also want to tell you that I have an online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, that rests this paradox into a truly doable form. That is, the daily practice that is an expression of whatever awakening has already arisen for you, or whatever simple holistic hygiene, health has ever arisen for you in a form that continually refreshes. I'm really gratified by what's arisen from the amazing creative process I've engaged in creating this online course. You know, a rich and authentic daily practice is really essential to real transformation and even full human happiness. And it's really hard for people to find their way into a truly transformative practice in the world today. It seems like people either have to choose between joining cults on one hand, or on the other, kind of hanging out in profane popular culture where the sacred really never gets enough traction to really break through. There are these spiritual morsels that are condiments, but the meal never, you know, the diet itself never gets radically changed. So I feel really gratified to have been able to develop an online course that really, truly, reliably helps any sincere person who's willing to take up a daily practice in just 8 sessions to move into a whole new phase of life and consciousness in an eminently doable step-by-step process that moves you from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's truly uncommon, grounded in the most radical and embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual traditions. And yet it's not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's that rarest thing, a deeply humane, heart-centered, self-compassionate path. It still generates the tapas, the yogic fire necessary for there to really be transformation. So you can find out more about that at the URL theispcommunity.com, THEISP, like Integral Spiritual Practice, community.com. Also, please stay on the line, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming with in our future dialogues. There may be a special, we're kind of just working out, we may have someone who can really talk about an enlightened relationship to our Christian tradition and coming back to that and becoming activated as a practitioner in relation to the full import of our lives and crisis time in a way that's responsible and incarnate on September 11th. I'm just taking off for a teaching trip to Brazil. I'll be just freshly back then. After that, though, for sure, on September 18th, Hamid Ali, who writes under the name A.H. Almas, will be joining me. And then I'll be talking with Daniel Siegel and several other really amazing people I'll tell you about at the end of the call. And we'll open up the lines at the end so we can hear each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, let's take a look at the questions that have been coming in. And let's begin with a question from Nina in Hartford, Connecticut, who says, Arjuna, isn't there some qualitative difference in your life and your consciousness now after meeting your teacher? It seems to me that if there isn't, then these insights, which I agree with, are intellectual only. And I would add, and wasn't your teacher an extraordinary being? Isn't there something that word enlightenment has, you know, doesn't it have some usefulness? Aren't there extraordinary beings who really have gone through some sort of qualitative shift? And isn't that qualitative shift important? And isn't there any importance in a qualitative shift being possible and worth speaking about? Didn't this enlightenment tradition invigorate and
hang on, sorry, I'm losing track.
Refresh. Yes.
Is it all her question, or is her question with you adding to it?
I read her question, and then I added to it.
Could you just go back to her question, because I wasn't quite sure where the demarcation came in.
The demarcation isn't there a qualitative difference in your life and consciousness after meeting Punjaji? And if there isn't, these insights, which she agrees with, seem to her intellectual only.
Yeah, okay. So her name is?
Nina from Hartford, Connecticut.
Nina. Hey, Nina. Thank you. So, wow. Well, the answer is, you know, is yes, yes, absolutely, beyond one's wildest dreams. And at the same time, in a funny way, no, but in a way that doesn't really matter. So yes, there is a qualitative difference because, you know, I mean, I guess the way to say it is that in my awareness, I was living inside a tiny room. You know, I was living inside a room 3 foot by 3 foot, you know, or whatever. And by meeting my teacher, you could say the walls of that room got broken down and I was exposed to the open sky. So, you know, what could be more incredible than that, to go from limitation to limitlessness in terms of my experience of myself? So in terms of an unconditional feeling of well-being, which is accessible, I'm not saying that it's there 24/7. I think that would be dishonest, but it's kind of accessible 24/7. If you, anytime you choose to come home to yourself, you can. But it didn't mean that the nature of the individual was sort of improved in a way that I had an agenda to improve it before I met him. This is the important thing. Before I met him, I was trying to fix this guy. His name was Nick, you know. I was trying to fix him. I was trying to improve him. I was trying to get, you know, which was really him, was trying to get more sex, more money, more this, more that. And so it kind of, it's clear that, first of all, that the guy is unfixable, but also the tendency to want to fix himself is part of who he is. So the thing is that kind of doesn't change. It's just, as I use the word, it shifts from being opaque to being translucent. So you just take yourself with more of a sense of humor. And there are lots of great things. Don't get me wrong. There are lots of great things about my life that I'm very grateful for. I mean, I have two incredible children, one of who's just gone off to college, who are just, you know, unbelievably gorgeous. I'm completely in awe at how these amazing beings came from this home that I created for them, and I've got a wonderful marriage and many fantastic things. I think the point is, Nina, it's not so much, yes, Punjaji was an incredible man, an incredible presence, a very powerful presence, but he was powerful in the sense that he didn't have a personal relationship to the idea of enlightenment. He had let it go. I think this is the important thing, is that the thing I want to emphasize about enlightenment is that holding the worst thing I would say you could do for yourself, the most sort of masochistic thing you could do, is live your life with the idea, I'm not enlightened now, and I'm going to get enlightened later. There's no better way to ruin your day than to hold that thought. Because when you have the idea, I'm on a path, I'm not enlightened, I'm going to become enlightened, then unconsciously, you just discredit all of the beauty that's in this moment now, because everything is about this future state. So that's the sense in which I suggest you cancel your subscription. And instead of focusing on a future state, what I would suggest to do is right here in this moment, pay attention to what's here. And you can do that in one of two ways, which in a way merge into each other. But one way to pay attention to what's here is to find out who you really are. To ask yourself the question, who am I? Who is experiencing all of this? And it won't open up right away necessarily, but if you turn your attention to your subjective nature and kind of dig down a little bit, it opens up, like clouds parting, it opens up into the open sky. So that's one investigation into now, is who is actually experiencing everything in this moment now. The other investigation into now is to notice what is coming to you through your senses. You know, and right now I can see flowers in my garden. I can see the trees that are clearly alive and vibrating. I can, you know, in a little while I'll go in and look in the eyes of my wife and see God looking back at me. And this is all mind-blowingly incredible. All of this stuff that's coming at me is unbelievably incredible unless we're caught in thinking. And when we get caught up in thinking, particularly spiritual concepts about enlightenment and, you know, evolution and all this stuff, we kind of lose our capacity to be here now. So yes, Punjaji was an amazing man. He still is an amazing spirit. But he wasn't an amazing man because he was on a path seeking towards a goal, nor was he teaching anybody else to do that. He was inviting people into the incredible mystery of now. And that's what I would suggest we all do. And the best way to do that is, you know, to give up on any thought of anything different than what's here and just stay here and find out what is actually here. Find out what is really here in yourself and in life, waiting to be met.
Beautiful. And going a little further, though, isn't there some value in pointing to the special quality, the radicality of the presence of someone like Puniji, and words like enlightenment came into being because of that. And that celebration of what that has done to invigorate and transform the way we've related to spirituality in the West, that enlightenment traditions really have done something. I want to just give you an opportunity to say some kind words about that word enlightenment, because I imagine in your holding of paradox, you have them.
Okay. Well, it gives you a really high Scrabble score. Except it doesn't have very high rating. I suppose G is quite a high rating letter, maybe H. It doesn't have any X's in it, but it would give you a pretty good Scrabble score. So there's something positive that I've said about enlightenment. But, you know, with someone like Puniji, or Byron Katie, for example, a very special person, or Eckhart Tolle, or many people like that, if you meet somebody like that, you know, in Safeways or something, if you bump into somebody who's really open and present, then, you know, hopefully if your heart is open, you'll feel touched. You'll feel touched by their beauty, and maybe tears will come to your eyes, and maybe you'll just feel tremendous love. Maybe you want to give them a gift, and all of that can be allowed because it's happening in this moment now. That's beautiful. And maybe you have a picture of somebody like that who you've already met, and you put the picture on your altar, and maybe when you look at the picture, you have genuine feelings that arise in your heart that are not cultivated. You have feelings. Well, then give in to the feelings and feel devotion and feel gratitude, and that's all good. The trouble that we get into is not with having a genuine response to life. I mean, certainly when I met Puniji, I was in love with him. You know, I would fall at his feet because it was a spontaneous reaction. The problem we have is not with genuine feelings that are arising in this moment. The problem we have is with concepts and maps which set up stages of consciousness that we try and understand with our mind, and then we use that complex web of explanation to really distract ourselves from what's here in this moment now. So when I say cancel your subscription to enlightenment, I mean cancel your subscription to the concept, the thing you think you understand about where we're heading, where you're heading in terms of your own evolution, because no one ever gets where they think they're heading, you know? And all of the energy that goes into trying to evolve, trying to make yourself evolve in some way, bring all that energy into now. And that's where Puniji lived. That's where Puniji lives when I tune into him. That's where any great teacher lives. Meet the teacher where they're living, which is in now, in the beauty and the mystery of now, not in a concept that you think you understand about the future. That's what I'm talking about, is just to really abandon the idea of thinking you know a future state you're heading towards. That's the big trap that most spiritually oriented people fall into, is they think they are on a path and they think they have a pretty clear idea about where the path is going. And it's all concept, and none of it will ever come true. It's all concept, which can become a really pernicious dead-end street. You know. Are there more questions, Terry?
Yes, there certainly are. In fact, I want to take some live questions.
Great,
someone calling on a phone on a phone number that looks like it's in Wailuku, Hawaii, Lawrence Carnicelli. I'm not sure who it actually is. You are live. Please introduce yourself.
Wow, aloha from Hawaii. Can you hear me?
Yes, aloha. Wonderful.
Wow, this is a great call. I very much appreciate being on the call with you, and thank you for taking it. My question kind of evolves and revolves around how being in the now, just accepting what is, and trying as best I can to be in the moment with whatever is, coincides and, I guess, relates to the law of attraction and quantum physics, and how it's just like, okay, I am also creating my own reality. And so there's this way with which, you know, the dance of it kind of feels as though my ego gets in the way in wanting and seeking and needing and whatever it is that it does. And so how can I dance in the moment and be present and also understand that I'm also creating my own reality?
Okay. Great, Lawrence. A couple of things. May I jump in there, Terry? Can I just jump in straight to responding?
Yes, that's the whole idea. Go right ahead.
So a couple of suggestions for you, Lawrence. First of all, I love it that you're in your own exploration and you're not looking for somebody else to solve the puzzle for you. So I encourage you to stay in inquiry and to reject answers that come from outside of your own experience. But, you know, I think you've just hit upon the paradox that clearly there is some aspect of your experience which shows you that your thoughts are magnetic and that you do have intention. Your intention is powerful and prayer is powerful. So clearly your experience demonstrates to you that what has been called the law of attraction is somehow matches something in your own experience. And at the same time, you can also relate to what we've been talking about here of just dropping into what's here and responding. So the answer to that paradox is not to be found in a book or a video. The answer to that paradox is to be found in Lawrence's precious human life. And Lawrence's precious human life is an alive book. It's an alive adventure. It's not even a movie that was put together with makeup and lights and an editing room. It's an alive adventure that's really happening, and your life is the teaching. So when you talk about law of attraction, I don't think that's a word that you made up. I suspect that it's a word that you've picked up from other people who've influenced you. And my encouragement to you, see, I'm not a teacher, I'm a coach. My encouragement to you would be to burn the books and the DVDs, except mine, of course, but no, that's a joke. But is to let your own life be the teacher and notice things that are happening in your life. Now, one thing I can just suggest to you about the law of attraction, as you called it, or which really points to the fact that what we think about is creative, what I would suggest to you, just as an experiment, instead of trying to use that to your advantage, instead of practicing I'm going to manifest things, instead, just maybe get a notebook. Get a notebook and just notice through the day how it works already without you doing anything about it. Just get a notebook and notice when things happen, how is this thing that happens somehow related to a thought or an impulse or a fear? And if you just pay attention to the way that the law of attraction is already a force in your life, rather than trying to use it to do something, I think you'll find it is actually much more powerful, because then you'll be learning from experience instead of trying to copy somebody else's formula. So that would be my suggestion to you about that one. It's just that if you just become aware, oh my God, that's how this works. It's like it's a eureka, and then it starts to work much more easily. The other piece I wanted to mention to you is you said your ego gets in the way. So this is what I would like to ask you to do. And it's a little bit tricky thing, but just try it out. For the next few days, I would like to ask you to really sincerely try to have a direct experience of the ego. Okay? So just set your intention. I'm going to try and locate and directly experience the ego. Not have thoughts about it or blame it or conceptualize about it, but actually directly taste the thing called the ego and see if you can find it. If you, and I don't want to give you any more than that, but if you go on a journey, you know, just like a journey to seek out the Holy Grail, go on a journey to seek out and find this thing called ego. And if you find it, please report back to me. You can reach me on, if you go to, my website's a little bit in transition right now for another couple of days, but go to, for example, awakeningcoachingtraining.com, awakeningcoachingtraining.com. Or just wait a few days. Terry's going to send you a link for something new we've just created. Go to the Contact Us section and just send me an answer, you know. What did you find? When you went to look for the ego, what did you find? See if you can discover the ego from direct experience rather than thinking about it. And the seeking for the ego and what happens as a result of seeking for it will potentially become the most powerful and transformative experience of your life. What I'm hearing, Lawrence, I don't know you yet. I hope I will get to meet you. But what I'm sensing, just intuitively from your question, is maybe it's time to lean a little less into thinking and reading and learning from other people and a little more into learning from your own life experience. So one thing you might do, which can be very powerful, is to do a retreat. If you can manage 5 days, it's perfect, where you just go alone. You know, you just go to a cabin or somewhere where you don't have contact with anybody. Don't take any books, don't take any notebook, don't take any pen, don't take a cell phone or a computer, nothing. Just go and be with yourself And then just open yourself up to your own life and see what you learn just by sitting with yourself. And I think you'll actually get more value from that 5 days than you would from a whole string of workshops with other people.
Thank you. I appreciate your answer.
Great, Lawrence. Well, get back to me, and I'd be glad to go deeper with you.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks, Lawrence. Thank
Aloha.
You for your call.
Aloha.
And we have another live caller now, Christy Johnson from Falmouth, Massachusetts, or someone
Hi,
with that phone call. Phone. Yes. Hi, Christy.
Actually, it's not. That I'm in a rented house, and that's her name, the landlady. My name is Claire.
Welcome.
Claire Rosenfeld, and I'm just vacationing here.
Oh, hi, Claire. Yeah, welcome.
Oh, this was such an amazing last hour. And your recent, the caller who just called and what you said to him was quite enlightening for me. Oops, I used that word.
Okay. All good.
I have always been trying to find what it is I'm meant to do. And I have done a lot, and I tend to discredit it, or I tend not to value it enough to see that it's already here, what I love to do and what I can do. And I don't plan the future well. I'm not good at that. And so by your saying to stay in the now and really explore deeply fits me better.
Yeah.
I'm in the last third of my life, and I am alone. I lost my husband a few years ago, and I'm in a position to you know, do that work in the cabin. And I have tons of books and notebooks from the past, which I keep thinking I'm going to find the gems that I wrote out before. And so it's not working for me, even though I keep on courses.
Good. Let me give you a little suggestion. Okay, this is a very integral part of awakening coaching, the method which I teach.
Yes.
So what you're pointing towards is what we call the unique gift. So
this
is what I would like to suggest to you. You know, do you have children?
Yeah, they're grown, and I have grandchildren.
Great. Okay. So those people, your children, your grandchildren, they probably really value you as a part of their lives, don't they?
Yes.
And you probably have friends as well who really value having Claire as part of their lives, right?
Right.
So I'd like you to do a little experiment. I'd like you to contact 12 people, 12 people who know you well, but not professionally. So in other words, if you were you wouldn't contact your fans, basically. If I was to do this exercise, I wouldn't contact my students. You contact people who know you well. Your children are good if you have brothers and sisters still alive. They would be good, you know. You contact people who know you well, and you just ask them, what is it about me that you really love and that you get from me more than you get from other people? And you're asking about qualities, right? And I would encourage, if you can, try and get 12 qualities from 12 people. So obviously, if I ask people that question, they're going to say you're funny, you're articulate, you're alive. These are the same qualities everybody will say, right? So what you want to do is get a catalog of the qualities that people really love about you, all right? Now, those qualities, once you compile them together, you'll find if you ask 12 people, many people will say the same things, which gives you a little bit of reinforcement. So those qualities are basically what you're here to do on the planet. Those qualities really summarize that is why you're here. From that point onwards, I would suggest to you it doesn't really matter that much what you do, quotes, with your time, so long as it provides a channel for those qualities to flow. For example, my natural qualities are I'm articulate, I'm quite funny, I'm creative, I like putting disparate things together. So for me to be a computer programmer would not allow my qualities to flow. But for me to teach in the way that I do, it really allows these qualities to flow. Now, I could equally go and teach in a school. You know, I could teach history in high school, and probably many of the same qualities would still be allowed to flow. What is going to give your life juice and purpose and meaning is that the qualities that you already have are given space to give themselves as a gift. What you actually do with it, whether you work in this place or work in that place, I think we put way too much emphasis on that. You know, and just to finish this up very briefly, you know, I can, I'm sure you can remember when your kids were very little, or when your grandchildren were little, right? And you can remember when they're very small, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And each child, each small baby has its own quality, doesn't it? You meet a baby, you meet one of your grandchildren, and they each have a unique flavor, a unique, like, a unique way of being in the world, right?
Right.
Yeah? But if somebody said, well, okay, so that's, who's that? Oh, that's my granddaughter or my grandson. Okay, so you can feel his. So what does he do? Well, he doesn't do anything. He's a baby. Yeah, yeah, but I mean, what does he do? What's his job? No, you don't understand. His job is to be a baby, right? So your job is to be Claire, right? And to allow the unique qualities of Claire to fully flow into the world. Once you get it that your job is to be Claire and to let Claire flow, just find something to do with your days that doesn't actually block Claire. So, if, for example, if you're a very loving person and very caring person, don't go on retreat or be alone because that wouldn't allow Claire to flow, you know. If you're a very funny person, you know, then don't do an accounting job because that wouldn't allow Claire to flow. It doesn't really matter that much what you do. And in fact, in many cultures, you're not even given the freedom we have here, you know, many Asian cultures or, you know, in many third world countries, you just do what your parents did and it's not a big deal. So we have so much freedom in our culture about, you know, should you do this job or should you do that job? We get overwhelmed by choice. Don't worry so much about what you do to make money. Just make sure that somehow your gifts are able to flow. So long as your gifts can flow into the world, you're going to be happy.
Thank you. That is perfect. Actually, yesterday I said that to myself, that it isn't what I do, it's how I do it. But this is much complete.
Well, much love to you, dear. Big, big love to you. And may you enjoy your vacation and come back refreshed and full of gifts to give.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. And thank you, Arjuna. We have arrived at incredible speed at the end of our time. So I'm so sorry we weren't able to ask more of the Instant Teleseminar questions. We had questions from all over the place. Very interesting, many different perspectives. Questions from Hong Kong, questions from Australia, questions from Europe.
Okay.
Yeah, quite.
Well, let me just say one more time then.
Quite interesting.
But I have spent the last several years putting together this investigation called Living Awakening, which is really it's a course in really how to live beyond seeking. It's a very, very rich, full course with a lot of incredible people involved in it. And it was supposed to be ready in time for this call, not quite ready. So watch your email box. In a few days, Terry's going to send you a link for that course. It'll be an invitation to watch some videos and things just so you can get the feeling for it. You don't have to make any decision. But if you register to watch the videos, then, you know, we'll be able to form a relationship and you know, we can, and Terry and I will be doing, I'm sure, more things together as well.
Okay, well, thank you. And just to make sure you have a few reminders. First of all, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it, and they can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life by taking my course in integral spiritual practice at theispcommunity.com. To learn more about my other work and see videos and audios and other writings, you can visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And coming up on Beyond Awakening, we may have a special guest on September 11th who if we were able to confirm this, she would be talking about the transformational spiritual power of coming home to Christianity in an intelligent and transformational way and learn how that can be an agent for cultural evolution. The email that I'll be sending later this week will perhaps announce that, and you'll be hearing about it if, in fact, it gets confirmed. In any case, for sure, on September 18th, I'll be speaking with A.H. Almas, Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond School, and our topic will be responsive enlightenment. Hamid Ali was born in Kuwait, steeped in the deep spirituality of his parents' Islam, Sufi tradition, but in the U.S. he became a student of many teachers of spiritual and psychological growth and knit them together
in what has become a very nuanced, intelligent, and enormously influential and leading edge school for psycho-spiritual integration, the Diamond Heart Approach. So be sure not to miss that. And in October, I'll be speaking with neuropsychiatrist Daniel Siegel, biologist Bruce Lipton, and activist Joanna Macy. So please stay tuned. There'll be many other remarkable conversations in the time ahead. Okay, well, let's open up the phone line so we can all say goodbye. Thanks so much, Arjuna, for joining us. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Love you guys.
Thank you. It was really, really helpful.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.